pastor in two different churches in more rural settings. So he brings lots of experience, both, I'm sure, successes and challenges in the rural setting, but has been in thriving congregations, and I'm sure he'll have lots of good stuff to share with us. So let's welcome Reverend Terry Armstrong.
Thank you, Mary. This might be easier and save my voice, and you get hear me a little better. Test 1, 2, 3. How's that? So, well, man, I'm honored and humbled to be here, and I have to be really careful to make sure everything I say is right on track, because Phil Albert was my district secretary before your district superintendent stole him from Illinois. Mike and I go. I turned it on, so. Mike and I go way back. We were roommates in college, Mike Palmer, and so it's a real treat for me to be able to be close. I was just telling Mary, it's 21 miles from our house to the setting today, so we're very close in proximity, and so it's good to be here. And I've come across some information in preparing for this that I think it will challenge us. I hope it will encourage us, and I am aware that it could frustrate us as we talk about some of these things. And I do not come to you with answers. In fact, the longer I've served now as a district superintendent, and I've only been doing it for 2.5 years, I know that I know less now than I knew then. Things are changing so rapidly, and questions and the journey seems to be getting tougher. I grew up in a parsonage. Mary mentioned my time as a pastor, but I started as a little guy in a parsonage in rural Oklahoma. My dad pastored in Newkirk, Oklahoma. His first Sunday, there were four of us. My dad, my mom, myself, and some teenage girl that came to the church that day. It was a town of, Newkirk was a town of 2,000. We moved from there to Granby, Missouri, which my mom says is in the sticks in Missouri, southwest Missouri, and it's a town of 2,300 people, so we moved up 100 people, and lived there for about 4 years. And then my dad took a pastorate in Baxter Springs, Kansas, which was 5,000, so we doubled in our community size, and there were a lot of farmers, ranchers in Baxter. From there, I began my ministerial career as a youth pastor near Tulsa, Oklahoma. Spent 6 years there, and from Tulsa, or Bartlesville actually, we moved to Medford, Oklahoma, which is 1,300 people. Most everybody was connected to agriculture in some way, shape, or form. Most of them were wheat farmers that would run cattle in the winter. And so that was kind of my first experience as pastoring in the lead pastor role. And it was a great church. They were incredible people that loved on a young pastor and helped build an opportunity for me to begin my pastoring career, I guess we might say, or to enact God's call in my life. Can I just get it? How many of you are pastors here? Okay, how many? So the rest of you are laymen. So I'm pretty sharp most of the time. How many of you are in communities less than 2,000 people? Okay, 2 to 5,000 people. All right, 5 to 10, somewhere in there. Okay. And I know that there's different descriptions of what rural looks like, but after 4.5 years in Medford, we moved to Guymon, America. Now, if you know anything about geography in Oklahoma, Guymon is in the center of the panhandle. I like to tell the people that when my son played football, his closest away football game closest away football game, they played five away games, his closest was 265 miles away. So we were out there. Now, most everybody would say we lived in the middle of nowhere. Has anyone ever said that about where you live? I like to say that we lived in the middle of everywhere. And Oklahoma is flat. And I love the idea of Mark Lowry, who says when he was in Guymon, Oklahoma one time, he said, "Man, I discovered that if I stand on my tiptoes, I can see the back of my head." It's so flat in Oklahoma. Well, that gives you a little bit about my experience of pastoring Guymon, the town of 10,000, for 17 years, and we had a great, great experience. I started to tell you about Medford and how the people loved on us. One day I was sitting in my office, and they had incredible facilities for this little tiny town. In fact, our family life center that we called it, I believe was the nicest building in town, and they built it before I got there to be pastor. But I was sitting in my office in the family life center, and Fern came over and knocked on my door. 90 years old, said, and we'd been there for about a year, year and a half, and she said, "Pastor, you know that I love you. I really do love you. And because I love you, I want you to have this book." And she handed me an English grammar book. A book that I needed, and I still need it. My wife works with me continually because my grammar is not the best. But she did it because she loved me. And one of the incredible advantages of the small rural church, the small rural community, is people love in the church, love the people. And in your churches, you have the opportunity to impact pastors for a lifetime. So I encourage you, laymen, love on your pastors. One of the things I discovered as a young person in growing up in a small community, in a small church, was that I needed, and I didn't realize that until later on when I got into ministry, but as a young person, I needed a district to be involved in. There were just a couple of us young people in our group. And I found that the district helped me grow up in my faith as much as anything else, because of the connectedness. And so what I realize, and now as a district superintendent, the value of the collective group of churches and of people. And so I encourage you, get involved in the district. One of the things that we're discovering as a district superintendent, though, because of the rural communities, is that we're having a hard time finding pastors. A lot of reasons. When people would come to Guymon, people would laugh at me because we had associate pastors there, and so whenever they came to Guymon, this town of 10,000 people, I would give them the 2-hour tour of Guymon, which most of my people in the church couldn't believe that I could tell them and show them anything for 2 hours in Guymon, because it doesn't take that long to go from one end of the town to the other. But I tried to make them understand all the value of the small community and the connectedness that could happen. And so we would spend 2 hours, but we were going to the Kids Inc. gym. We were going to where the ball fields were at. We were going to out by Seaboard Farms, the pork processing plant. We were going to all the different places that the people in the community, that was important to them. And so I think those are some important things as you begin to think about living, growing in your faith in the small rural town church. We're discovering, though, that churches aren't able to afford full-time pastors. So they're moving towards bivocational pastors, which I think is a good idea. But one of the things that we're working on our district, you know, when you're bivocational, it means, you know, you're working at the church, collecting a little bit of money from the church, and you got to go out and find another job that has usually a time clock, has expectations upon you, and so it's hard to make all that work together. You got to have somebody that you can work for that understands the role of a pastor, the needs of the local church. And so we've begun to discover that if rural churches could go together and have a circuit pastor, it's much easier to control your schedule when you're in control of your schedule. And so circuit pastors, which is not a new thing, circuit rider pastors in the Methodist movement long time ago, but we're discovering that it's a possibility as well. I'm talking an awful lot, so anytime you want to ask questions or make comments, please throw something at me and we'll do that. Reasons rural churches are discovering that there's decline going on. And a lot of different reasons why decline is happening. Maybe you have some reasons. Maybe that'd be a good point for you guys to share a little bit. You have any thoughts? Why are the rural communities declining? People move off, young people move off, and don't come back.
The young ones are leaving.
The young ones are leaving.
Jobs.
Sometimes there's not a lot of places to work in the small communities. So here's some of the things that I came across that you've already mentioned, but cultural shift from the church being the social center of community activity to being just one of many. I don't think that's a problem in just the rural churches. That's a problem in all the churches. But particularly, there's a lot going on. Used to, when my kids were young, you didn't have baseball practice on Wednesday nights. You didn't have activities scheduled on Sundays in the schools or in the community. And that's all shifted. Most every place, there's those kind of things. Population shift out of rural America. Many feel that the church is not important in their life. There's nothing there for me type of attitude. I think that's a question that we need to think about when people, okay, so what is it that we can do to begin to answer some of those questions? Church is too old-fashioned, lack of upkeep, financial resources, people resources. I don't know about Missouri district, but I know in Illinois district that's a reality in many of our local churches out there, the small rural communities, keeping the facilities up. Some of them, when I go in, the mildew has permeated the atmosphere, and it's tough. Here's one that I thought's very truthful, but kind of interesting. Rural people deal with a great deal of social exposure, meaning everybody knows a great deal about everybody. And relationships become surface level. No longer live in a front porch society, making contact and befriending people and just getting to know them more difficult. And this is probably the last one that I think reasons for decline is probably one of the most real struggles that I've had to deal with as a district superintendent, and I think it's one of the most sad. Internal conflict. Most conflict resolutions in rural churches ends in a ceasefire where people restore a surface of equilibrium. They are typically not led all the way to an armistice, meaning that you just kind of bear it. And you never really resolve the internal conflict, so it lives on in the life of the church. And I'm convinced that the outside community knows when there's internal conflict in the life of the local church or one of the local churches. And I just sat through Dr. Crutcher's entire sanctification or sanctification 101, and holiness is about love, right? Loving like Christ loved. And sometimes in the church. But I do believe there's great benefits in the rural church, in the small communities. Families, smaller churches have more of a family atmosphere, and I think that's great that when it's not conflicted. It allows you to build strong relationships, and I love the fact that in most rural churches, Everybody knows your name. Someone ought to write a song about that. Wayne, you know a song about that? Everybody knows your name? So we want to learn our talk today about learning to thrive in a rural church. So here's what I want to suggest to you. We're going to talk about this book a little bit, but we don't have near enough time to talk about the whole book. So I want to encourage you to take note. And for those of you that are working in the rural church, in the rural communities, this is a great book. I don't agree with everything in the book. So you don't have to agree with everything to find some helpful ideas in the book. It's written by a fellow by the name of John Sanders. He was a fireman in Peoria, Illinois. His lifelong dream was to be a fireman. He got his lifelong dream and began to work. And God got a hold of him and said, I want you to go to rural Iowa, a town of around 2,300 people, and I want you to plant a church. That's not a Nazarene church, but I'm guessing that most of us are thinking, okay, did you really hear from God to go to a small community and plant a church? But that's what John Sanders did, and he's done an incredible work. And if you, he's got a website, smalltownbigchurch.com, and I think that you will see that he's been very successful. He's learned how to thrive in a rural community, and so we want to talk about some of these. So, rescue. You can probably guess that you know what he did. He used the word as an acronym, right? Isn't that what every good teacher does? So we want to talk through these for a moment, but I think what I like best about his concept in his book is that he just doesn't use the words rescue, but he talks about the attitude and the idea of fire service and likens it and compares it to the life of the church. I have four children. Two of them are connected with EMS and fire service. One, our youngest, is a firefighter in Oklahoma City, firefighter paramedic in Oklahoma City. And our oldest is an ER doctor, actually in your state, on your district, and he attends your, so I hope you don't ever run into him in his occupation anyway. But he's involved in a rural town volunteer fire department. And there's so much about recognizing that the church, our mission, is very similar to that of firefighters. What's a firefighter do? Fight fires. They help people that are in need. Most of them are connected somehow to EMS, emergency medical services that deal with car accidents and those kind of things. So they have a mission, and he likens that. And so this is what we're going to talk about for a few moments, and we're going to focus on two of them, but I want to run through them real quick. He says we got to recognize the mission. Firefighters know what their mission is. Their mission is to put out the fire or to help the people in need. It's not to just be comfortable in their firehouse. Their mission is to go out into the community when the fire alarm goes off and to rescue those in need. They recognize their mission. I mean, wouldn't it be kind of strange if the firefighter heard the bell and went off and they got off their bunker gear on and they went out to the address that they were given and they started talking to the person that was in need and said something like, well, tell me what's your political affiliation. And if you agree with me, then we'll put out your fire. That's not what a firefighter does. He has a mission. Folks, we as the church, we have a mission. Christ came to seek and to save the lost. He didn't come for us to build just nice, comfortable buildings or fellowship times that you and I can get together and talk and have a good meal together. And I love those times in the church. I love those times, but that's not our purpose. That's not our mission. And if we are going to rescue, be used to rescue, and the the church, whether it be in a small community or in a large city, we have to recognize what our mission is, and we have to be aware of those things. Too many churches have allowed their mission to become keep the church pure and my life comfortable. So here's just a few questions that you can ask yourself about your mission in your church to determine whether or not we are on mission. Number one, is the gospel being proclaimed? Is it being presented passionately on a weekly basis? When I read this from this guy, I had to think, you know, sometimes I go into these churches and I'm thinking, these people don't need to hear a message of gospel. They need to be challenged and kicked out of their comfortableness and get out into there. But religion in the small communities has become a religion and not a relationship with Christ. And so, pastors, those of you that raise your hand, you and I need to be intentional in presenting the gospel continually, challenging those that are sitting there listening to hear the gospel and know that it's life transforming. Are there people being saved? When my first report as a district superintendent, my challenge was, I want you to think and focus not on your attendance, but upon the number of converts, on the number of new members, and the number of people being baptized in your church. And it's not easy. I know it's not. And I don't have all the answers here, but I do believe that we have to remember why we are there. We're to help keep people from burning up in the fire, the eternal fire of hell. Are people being baptized? Are people being rescued from destructive lifestyles and walking in freedom? Are people coming through your doors on a regular basis? And as I thought about that in the small community in Medford, Oklahoma, how do I get people? I mean, most people in Medford, Oklahoma, if you were to go there and you would ask them about their church, most, about 90% would say, at least when I was pastoring there, well, I go to church. But the truth of the matter is, they didn't really. They had a place that they called their church, but there was a lot of them that didn't attend. And I think there's people in there that out there that need to be reached. Do guests feel welcomed and accepted? And is your church outward focused? Recognize the mission. Secondly, he said, you got to execute strong leadership. The fire department has a very distinct chain of command. And when someone is there that's listed as the incident commander, they are the ones that bark out the orders and the directions to save the lives of people. So in the church, who do we think should be the leader of the church?
Pastor.
Do we really believe that? We think that we do. And that's the right answer. We believe, and you know, I've been in the Nazarene Church all my life. Probably many of you have been in for a long time. And so we go through this process when we get a new pastor. And we will declare, as laymen, church board members, district superintendents, God has directed and given us a leader for the church. And the pastor comes in, and who's really the leader of the church? Church boss, or the
boss.
Yeah. So somehow we, as the people of God, need to believe that God can call and place in leadership a pastor that will lead the church. And unfortunately, I've been in this long enough, 2.5 years, that I've dealt with already several church boards and conflicts in the pastor. Now, let me be the first to say that not all of us pastors None of us pastors are perfect. We all have things that we can learn and need to work on. But somewhere along the line, we got to execute some strong leadership and give the pastor authority to be the God-given leader in the church. In the fire service, you rely heavily upon the chain of command, all the way from the top, all the way down to the bottom of the firefighter. Doesn't mean that the captain or the incident commander doesn't get involved and engage, but they're the ones calling the directive. They're the ones that take the blame when something happens. I understand that. But somewhere along the line, we got to execute strong leadership. Speak a compelling vision. The fire service calls people into something bigger than themselves. Fire service is clear in their mission. The fire service casts a vision that calls out the best in people. It calls people to give themselves to something that is bigger and better than themselves. Our youngest son is named Kip. K-I-P. And I was with him just not too long ago, and we were talking about risk. And he started giving me some statistics, and I can't quote them to you. I didn't write them down. But what he was saying to me, firefighting is a very dangerous job. It's not just a matter of the moment when you go into a fire, but there's contamination kind of stuff that can affect. Firemen have a very high rate of cancer. I mean, it just, he goes on down the whole list of stuff saying that firefighting is a very risky job. But you know what? When he applied for that, there was, I don't remember the exact number, something like 30 positions open, and there were over 200 people that applied. Why? Because they believed in something, that they were being a part of something that was going to help somebody. And there was this vision of them becoming some sense of hero and willing to help somebody. And people were willing to die to help others. And so in the life of the church, you and I need to realize that we must be speaking this vision to help all of us realize that we have a task, a mission that we talked about a moment ago, that is lifelong, eternal in its value. And when we can speak this compelling vision, it will make a difference. So here's some thoughts about that. I kind of messed up my deal, so can I come back to that for a minute? The next one is cover the community, and we're going to talk about that as well. The last one is embrace the future and honor the past, okay? So let's talk about this compelling vision. God is a giver of a compelling vision. It seems when people seek God with prayer and fasting, somehow God chooses to respond. If we have a mission that's that important, that will make a difference in people's eternity, and God gives us a vision of how we're going to reach them with strong leadership in place, and we pray and fast, I believe God is going to respond and use us to impact rural America in such a way that lives will be changed and transformed, and your churches, our churches in our district, can grow even in small places. God is the giver of a compelling vision. Layman, help your pastor pray and seek God to know what His vision is for you and your church. God is the giver. Secondly, God-given vision will be much bigger than you. I don't know about you, but that scares me. Because I know what I'm able to do, and sometimes I get caught up on the idea, okay, Terry, I can get this accomplished. But God's vision is bigger than me. I don't have enough wisdom and resources to accomplish God's vision. But it is bigger than me. It will exceed my comprehension. And it will require people and resources that we do not have. But you know what? If he gives us the vision, don't you believe that he will provide the resources that we need to make it happen? So just know that it's going to be bigger. God often gives the vision before the people and the resources to accomplish the vision. God gives the vision before the people and the resources are there. I don't know about you, but I don't like that very well. I like to count the cost. I like to know that I have enough money in the bank. And in my own heart, I've been working on this one for last several weeks, thinking about our district responsibilities. And I know I have to be a good steward of what you, the local church, provides for the district, but yet I shouldn't just be a banker stockpiling money. I got to find ways to invest the resources that God has for us in a way that makes a difference and helps the local church accomplish God's vision for them. That's where we're at. A compelling vision takes you far beyond your comfort zone. It will demand, say that word there, it will demand and risk. And it's not going to be comfortable. It's not going to be comfortable, folks, if we follow God's vision. God-ordained vision always creates more questions than answers. I don't know about you, but I like the answers first. But God's vision is going to ask us more of us. It's going to require that sacrifice. It's going to require that risk. Why? Why would you do that? Why would you make that sacrifice? Why would you take those risks? Because it's God's vision. And He has us on a mission, doesn't He? To make a difference. A God-given vision will draw some people in. And can we just skip that last line? But I think Sanders is right. A God-given vision will draw some people in, and it will push away others. Because some are not interested in what God has for us. Going back to what Dr. Crutcher shared in here, and some of you heard him this morning, we're turned inward. We're focused on ourselves. We have this selfish desire to do our own thing. A God-given vision requires stubborn determination. Here's where you can use stubborn in a good way. You've got to be determined that you're going to follow through in God's vision. Again, from my short experience as a district superintendent, I think this is where so many of our churches are struggling. Our small churches in rural communities are struggling because there's not unity in the camp. There's division. There's strife. Everybody wants their own thing. But a God-given vision requires an environment of unity. So can I just say to you, I mean, you don't know me and I don't know you very well, and you don't know me very well, you just met me. But if somehow you and I can go back into our local settings and help create such a strong, overwhelming sense of unity in the life of the church, I think unity alone will begin to build and reach and touch the lives of people, because most everything in our society and culture right now is divided. But that's not where God wants us to live. He wants us to live in unity. So if we can find a way, and I think that way happens through prayer. So pray together as the body of Christ. Pastors, call your people to pray together. I would say that one of the things that, if I had one thing to say, what was the most effective part of your ministry, it was this desire that we would meet together weekly in prayer. And so for the last, before I became a DS, almost every Monday night, our house was open from 7 to 8, and anybody in the church would want to come, that wanted to come, was invited to come, and we would have an hour of prayer. And you know what's really sad? is that not very many people would ever show up. I'm telling about myself and my own, I guess, leadership from that standpoint. We called our people every week to this time of prayer, church of 320 people. And the most we ever had on a Monday night for an hour of prayer was 10. And that breaks my heart. And somehow I wasn't able to challenge our people to really commit. But unity through prayer is so vitally important. God-given vision will help you to say no to the good things and say yes to the best things. I don't know about you, but I find this one to be pretty hard. A lot of people come to me and say, they would come to me and say, Pastor, I have a good idea. And I would listen to their idea and believe, yeah, it's a good idea. But it wasn't the best idea for us to put our time and our effort into. And this God-given vision will help you say no to the good things and yes to the best things. And finally, vision leaks. So say it often. What do you think he means by that? This is all Potter Sanders stuff. What's it mean that vision leaks? Yeah. You got to continually be saying it. So pastors, if you got a vision from God, you got to find ways over and over and over and over again. And then when you thought you've said it enough, you start saying it again, over and over and over again, so that the vision that God's given to you as a leader is instilled in the lives of the people. One of the things I had always hoped in Mustang the last 12 years of my ministry was that if someone asked them what the vision of our church was, that the people could say it. That we were a people who would love Christ and welcome people so that He could change their lives. And so, speak it often. Okay, cover the community. How's my time? I got 8 minutes, or about until 3:45, right? Cover the community. Number one, we've already talked, preach the gospel. Two, stand for God's word. I mean, folks, God's word is it. It's the authority that we stand by. So don't ever let that get by. Be active in reaching your community. I was, when I pastored Medford, one of the greatest advantages, both in Medford and Guymon, was I had four small children. And they were engaged, involved in the life of the community. And I loved it when people would begin to say to me, well, there comes Chad's dad. There comes Amy's dad. Or there's Kip's parents. Because my kids were becoming known in the community and involved and engaged. So we have to be, as pastors and people, active in the community. So, meet the needs in your community. Crisis situations. Be the church that responds. I just met with a board just the other night, and I said to and they're in a small community, and they're a dying church. And I said to them, so what happens if we close the doors to this church? What will people in this community say is missing because you're gone? And the best that they could come up with was, well, if we were gone, no one would probably mow the grass, and people would begin to notice how shabby the building was looking. That's how they're known in the community. Meet the needs of the community. Find out what the needs are and begin to meet them. That's what Sanders says. They would hear of a widow that needed a porch put on. They would hear of the food bank that needed help. He would talk about even hearing of other churches that were doing fundraisers, and their church would go and volunteer to help them raise funds with a dinner or something that they were doing. Find ways to meet the needs in your community. And then also engage and serve the youth of the community. And part of that in meeting the needs is finding ways to not just in the... We often think of needs as the struggles, but Guymon had pioneer days. And we looked for ways that we as a church could be out in pioneer days, getting our name out there to help meet the needs of whatever the community. It wasn't a thing that was hurting. It was just a way to get out and be involved in the life of that helped when it fan shut off. So meet the needs and engage and serve the youth of the community. One of my most fun things to do in Medford, the Family Life Center that they built was a vision of a fellow by the name of David Nolenberger that had grown up in that community, gone away to serve, went to college, and came back to the community and taught for 20 years. He was the business teacher. When I got there to become their pastor, David had just beaten cancer. And just before I got there, they had this incredible celebration of David's life and God's miraculous touch in his life. And he had this vision that this church, this little church in this community of 1,300 people, 60 people, would build this Family Life Center, and they put a gym in it. And so it was David's vision that this church would make a difference. So when I became the pastor, one of the suggestions I had was that we would hire a youth pastor. And Don Schuneman had been the former superintendent of schools. He was now retired from that and was farming, had Belgium horses, these incredible big Belgium horses. And he was served on the board, been a stalwart, a pillar in the community and in the church. And I brought it up, and he told me later, he said, "Pastor, I thought that was the dumbest idea anyone had ever had, that we would hire a youth pastor in Medford, Oklahoma." But we did, and there's an incredible story about how God used this part-time youth pastor that lived in a town 30 miles away from us and built a relationship with a young student. And that student went away to college. And it's just an incredible story. But he told me later, after I'd already left, that he thought that was such a dumb idea. But we were determined that we were going to engage the community by hiring a youth pastor. And so one of the things that we would do is a basketball Bible memorization camp. And it was a little bit before camps were so busy in the school system. But it was a way to engage and serve the youth, and we had a great time doing that. So you probably can't have a basketball camp because there's probably a dozen of them already at your school, but what are some ways that you can engage the youth in the life of your community? Teach and model biblical generosity. I'm so thankful that God is a generous God and that he was willing to sacrifice his son so that I might be able to live. And we need to be generous people. And I've been thinking and working in the life of our district, how can we be more generous? Can I just tell you one of the ideas that God gave to me? We cut our budget during the beginning of COVID for the district because we were concerned. Churches, you know, had to close their doors. And what in the world are we going to do? How are people going to make their budgets, pay their budgets? So we did everything we could to trim our budget back. And God was incredible, and the people of our district was incredible, and they gave, and we had more money left over in the bank than we ever anticipated. So last year at District Assembly, or right before District Assembly, we announced we're going to give grants back to the local churches. And we gave back to our local churches on our district over $160,000 back to them from their funds that they had paid in, because they weren't my money. It wasn't my money. It wasn't the district money. It belonged to the local church. And so we had to teach and model generosity. And I just had an advisory board meeting this morning, and our giving this year is about $60,000 over last year's. I think it's because we practiced generosity, and people saw that we weren't in this just for the district. My model all the time is, the local church doesn't exist to prop up a district. the district exists to respond, to encourage, and resource the local church. And so we got to teach and model generosity. Be visible and available to the people in your community. Probably most churches in my district that are in small communities, particularly if the pastor's having to work, there's no one at the church all week. The church is open and available Sunday morning from 8:30 to 12, I don't know. But how are some ways that you can make yourself available and people could see that the church is available during the week? I don't have answers for you, just some ideas and thoughts of something for you to consider. And then finally tonight, today, Unleash the Volunteers was the U in there. And then the last one is Embrace the Future, Honor the Past. I think too many of us, we get that reversed. We embrace the past and we talk about the future. But if we're going to embrace the future with this God-compelling vision of what He wants us to do, we have to recognize that we are going to have to make changes. Which shouldn't surprise us, should it? Because God is a God of change. The very nature of what He does in us, He creates in us to be new creatures in Christ. So change shouldn't be something that we take lightly. It shouldn't be something that we push aside, well, because we have all this in the past. And we need to honor our past. And sometimes we need to find ways to return to the past. But for the most part, we just got to find ways to move forward, new methods. We don't lose the message. We just change the methods of how we're going to accomplish these things. So how do we bring about change in the rural church? Here's six thoughts that we'll close with. Explain the why behind the what. Explain the why behind the what. Help one another see the cost of not changing. You see, sometimes we always focus on, well, it's going to cost us to change. But I venture to say that it's going to cost us just as much, if and not more, if we don't bring about changes. Help people identify the difference between preference and scriptural truth. I have my particular flavor of songs that I prefer. Okay, I'm not going to tell you what they are, but I have my own preference. It doesn't have anything to do with Scripture. It's just what I enjoy. In Guymon, the church there was an incredible church, and we did. There were some great things that happened. But I think it was in part because of the attitude of Thelma Bryan, who sat on my church board, had been the church treasurer for many years, and she looked at me one night early on in my ministry and said, "Pastor, it's more important to me that we reach my children and or my grandchildren than it is that you please me. I'm more interested in making sure that we do what it takes to reach my grandchildren than what it takes to keep me happy." And it was that kind of attitude that helped that church to grow and to move beyond and see God's compelling vision. And it wasn't about her preference. It was about the mission, the biblical mission to seek and save the lost. When you bring about change, call change an experiment. Let's try something new. If it doesn't work, we can go back to what we were doing. I remember more than once that we kind of incorporated that kind of mindset. And when we started, we said this is only for 6 weeks or 6 months, whatever the time frame was. And we started to go back to the other one, and people would even say, "We don't want to go back to what we were doing. We want to keep doing what we're doing now." But we gave permission, and we didn't lock in that this is a forever change. So call it an experiment. Let people know the one thing that will remain constant in your church. Let people know that the one thing that will remain constant in your church is change. Work to cultivate a culture of change. Sanders in his book suggests you should change your platform regularly. Make it different. Create an atmosphere of change. Honor past faithfulness without overemphasizing past strategies. I don't want all this talk of change to say that history doesn't matter, that traditions are not important. But instead of focusing on the methods of the past, focus on the people of the past. You know, your methods, these methods that you, when you honor these people that change methods, they probably fought the same kind of battles that you're having to fight and change to be successful along the way. And remind people that change is at the core of the heart of our message. God changes us from the inside out. We must put aside the past, the traditions, and God's desire is not to see your church become stagnant. He wants us to thrive. And so that's my prayer for each of us, that we will look for ways to survive and thrive in our current day culture, and that we will allow God's mission, and we will see God's compelling vision that He has for us to accomplish His mission, and that God's name and kingdom will be glorified and expanded. So, thanks for your time. Hopefully, there was something that you can take out of here, and that you will find helpful as you go back to your small communities with a big God who wants to do bigger things and make a difference in eternity. Amen. Good. Thanks.
Thank you.
Any questions or comments? Suggestions?
How many potlucks did you have?
A lot. I don't remember that we had a pattern of once a month or anything at any one of our places, but I know that we had a lot of them. Special occasions. Baptisms. This is just something that we found to be helpful, was that whenever we had baptisms, we created announcements, invitations, and gave them to the family and said, invite all of your family and friends. And it was so fun to see kids get baptized and their teacher to show up, because they had given their teacher an invitation, and it gave us an opportunity for them to hear. And I would venture to say that many of them probably went to church, but it was important enough that they would come and be a part of it. And somewhere along the lines, God's seed was planted. 2 Corinthians 9:6 talks about when you sow sparingly, you reap sparingly. But when you plant generously, you will reap generously. So go and reap generously in God's grace and love. Any other questions? Comments?
I'm from a small rural community of like 847 people. Maybe 200 is within the city limits. The rest of it's farmers outside. And within this small community, we have a Nazarene church, a Baptist church, a Methodist church, a Christian church, Catholic church. And there's still a lot of people in that community that is not churched. Being the pastor in this community for 5 years, I don't know what it is that's going to have to get to these other people, to reach these people that are not coming to church in any of the churches. So what are some ideas? I know we have like the Memorial Day service park, service in the park. People come to that. That's once a year. Yeah. They come for that. We don't see them no more. What are some thoughts, some ideas of, how do you reach these people with the community that has so many churches but there are still people that are not church?
Well, I don't have a whole lot of answers. The first thing that comes to my mind is, and pastors directly to you, if you can stay put, stay put. Your presence there, particularly in these small kind of communities, if you stay through and stay there and stay there and pastor and people come to know who you are, you will become the town, because so many pastors are, and it's that way in the Nazarene church. We're here today and gone tomorrow in so many situations. But if you can stay put, you will build relationships with people in the community and become the community pastor. And even though they may even go to the another to the Baptist church, if their pastor happens to be new and they've built relationships with you, so number one, build relationships. Pastor, stay put as long as possible. Find ways to just make yourself known. What? So ask the question: what are we going to be known for by this community? My father-in-law just passed away last week, and so he lived in a town of 5,000, just under 5,000 people, Redwood Falls, Minnesota, and Glendon was known as the Cookie Man because he baked cookies continually and went to businesses and gave cookies away, plates of cookies. Christmas, he gave over 140 plates away. And that was his ministry. And so he was known as the Cookie Man. And so what are some ways that you can be known in the community? So I know in Redwood Falls, there are a lot of businesses, the funeral home, the flower shop, the hospital, the auctioneer place. Glendon is going to be missed because he's not going to bring in any more cookies to them. So what can you as a congregation be known for that if you quit doing it, you're going to be missed? So that would be the one thing that I would say is find something that people are going to recognize that you're known to do in the community along the way. Talk to a lot of people. Ask a lot of questions. At the coffee shop, you know, find out what they need.
That's a good question. I mean, the town has no grocery store. It has a Casey's.
Woo-hoo. Is that where everybody meets?
You know, there's no restaurants. There's nothing there. So it makes it, you know, the next towns are both ways. Twelve miles away, three different directions. So, you know, it's kind of troubling. You know.
Well, brother, I commend you, number one, for being willing to be called by God to serve there. And number two, just keep praying, asking God how you can knock on those doors or reach those people and build those relationships. And I believe God will give you an avenue by which you can be known in that community. And unfortunately, it doesn't sound like you have a coffee shop. So I thought every community had a coffee shop. Yeah.
You know, I actually might have a little bit of insight into your question. First of all, if you didn't go to it, the collaboration over isolation class during the first session that was put on by Larry Thomas answers some of that. And it was a very, very informative class. And if you didn't go to that, I would check that out on the video on the website. And also, where I'm from in Poplar Bluff, it's on the larger side of rural. I mean, we have 17,000 people in our town. We still pretty much know each other. And some of the ways that I've seen in our community that we focus on that, and Larry talks about that in the class too, is we don't need to be isolated in our churches. We should reach out to our other denominational brothers and sisters and work with them. And I know in Poplar Bluff that one of the ways that they do that is like, for instance, every single year at the beginning of the school year, all of the pastors in the community gather at the junior high school in the gym, and they have a convocation for our school year. And they pray over our school district. And whenever we have tragedies or things that happen in our community, they are in the schools praying with our children. And fortunately, we have a superintendent in our school district that allows that. But that's one of the first ways that in a small community like that is go to the children where the children are, minister to them, volunteer in your school districts. I know ours has grandparents come and eat lunch with the kids, or even parents can come and eat lunch with their children at the school district, in the schools, and that's the very first place to start. And actually,
Dan Boone?
He was speaking about that too, is that that's the very first place to start when it comes to the tags that were given, these gender, the LGBTQ and all of this stuff. And he's like, if you want to minister, start in the elementary schools, because these kids are confused and they don't know what to do. And when you start ministering to these kids, it starts to gravitate towards the parents as well. And when they see you invested in those kids' lives, they start wondering what's going on. And just look for places in your community where you can be helpful, where you better their lives.
Very good. So I don't know, do you have a school in your community even? Do they? Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Well, I commend you for loving those people, and they do need a godly influence of men and women that love them. So keep up the good work. I don't want to get kicked out for going over. So thanks for coming.
Thank you.